It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, closing the education achievement gap is a top priority for Wisconsin School Superintendent Tony Evers. He delivered his State of Education address yesterday. We'll check out the state's priorities.
First, you could probably share a story where someone was rude about every week or so, or maybe you'd admit that there were times when you could have been more polite.
Our next guest makes the case for practicing politeness. We're not talking etiquette and manners here, just politeness. In a recent piece, he says politeness has a stubborn power over time, and it helps us and the people we live and work with.
Paul Ford joins us now. He's a writer, editor, and programmer. His piece on politeness appeared at medium.com, and we have a link to it on the Central Time Facebook page. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Paul, your politeness has an origin story. How did you get to be so polite?
Well, I mean, you can go all the way back and look at me as a child, and I was sort of taught to be polite. But I think over time, it was learned. It was learned by terrible trial and error, and I learned that just by incredible patience and just sort of keeping my mouth shut, life was going a lot better for me.
And you say you don't look like you should be polite. People don't expect it from you. Why is that?
I'm just a big goofy guy, right? And so people see me and they're just sort of, they want to know what position I played. They don't think I'm going to sort of be quiet and modest.
Well, how does your politeness make itself known? What do you mean when you talk about being polite in your daily life?
Well, the whole point is nobody should really ever know. It's only over time that every now and then someone will pull me aside. And, you know, I worked on a big project a couple years ago with somebody, and this is a person who's like a real corporate go-getter. And she took me aside at the end of the project, and we'd been in a room for about 6 months, and she's like, I thought you were just a terrible suck-up. Like, I just thought that you were just some kind of weasel. And then I realized that over time, you're just sort of letting people talk and figuring it out. And that was actually a strategy. I was like, well, I wasn't quite that conscious, but it was sort of interesting to see somebody who is used to just like, she just sort of puts her shoulders down and plows through the wall to get stuff done, observing that I'd accomplished the same thing through this process of, like, erosion.
And do you get that kind of reaction to politeness, that it's a strategy, a gambit, or do people not notice it at all sometimes?
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, nobody really notices it. The fun thing in that piece is that I'm sort of playing all my cards at once, right? Like, I shouldn't really be out there saying, look at how polite I am. That's the least polite thing you can do. But I woke up one morning and I was just like, you know, people have mentioned this to me a few times. And I sort of felt that, I'm an internet guy, I'm a programmer, and it's such a rude medium. Everyone's just yelling at each other all the time, and it's exhausting. And I wanted to kind of bring up that, like, you know, some of us are just kind of sitting there trying to get by. And of course, people popped up out of the woodwork and yelled at me right away for saying that. But that's okay. That's fine. I'm actually very happy and welcome their feedback.
You tell a story, or at least you make a really convincing case for being polite, and one that really hit home with me was that you said that, you know, when you're polite, you don't really have as much baggage to carry around. You said it's sort of like wearing white gloves. You don't sully yourself by getting dirty, and when the unfortunate encounter or whatever is over, you take off your gloves, you move on, and you're fine because you've kept it together.
I mean, I think this is what people miss about it, right? Is that every time you jump in and decide to have an opinion, and there's this huge, you know, Twitter is a great example, but just in general, there's this huge pile-on of opinions. It's very tribal, where someone says something and someone else says, I disagree with that, and then there's just, you know, an outpouring of rage. Not getting involved with that is the least emotionally exhausting way to live your life. Like, as everyone is expressing opinions and formulating opinions about each other as individuals, you can kind of, it's amazing how liberating it is to sit there and be like, well, you know, this guy might just be having a bad day, or, you know, and there's a subtext there too, which is that actually a lot of the friendships that I've had that have evolved over the years have truly evolved. You know, I found out that I met that person and I thought they were being terrible, and it turns out they were having a really bad day, and, you know, they hurt their leg. A friend of theirs had just passed away or whatever. And if you let those first impressions actually define your relationships, you're in big trouble.
Well, you, speaking of Twitter, you tweeted, "I'm here to talk the Wisconsin public radio show about politeness, which is like talking to a French person about cheese." Do you think we're really that polite in the Midwest, or are we just shy or something?
No, you guys are polite. I mean, I've been living in New York City for a while. New York City is, in its own way, New York City is one of the most exceptionally polite places you'll ever go. And not always on the street, but like the relationships that I have had with my neighbors. Some of my best friends are neighbors, and that sort of builds. You let those build over years. You don't rush those, right? So there's this sort of certain distance that everyone being jammed together creates in New York City that you kind of, if you can decide to live here, you celebrate. But no, you come to the Midwest and people are genuinely very polite and friendly. You know, there's that friendliness and that sort of distance that's also in there. There's a kind of like, okay, everyone's got it. We're going to be very nice to each other, but there's a little room.
Isn't there anything stifling about that sometimes where, you can't talk about the things that really matter because you're so busy being polite?
Well, but when I'm with my friends, I'm one of the least polite and most sort of, I'll say, the most horrifying and upsetting things. Like, I don't have a lot of filter. One of the reasons I think I've learned to be polite is that horribleness always lurks within me. And I'm always trying to, like, you know, it's not a matter of like, oh, I might say the inappropriate thing. I will say something or I will think something so unbelievably terrible that just to conceive of it is, it feels bad. And to say it out loud would ruin friendships all around.
Right, so you're freaking me out here.
Yeah, this is a survival mechanism for me. This is not, you know, it's a way for me to, I think everybody has that terrible little screaming voice in their head, right? But you just like it's. I don't know. I don't find it stifling. I mean, you're exposed to so many people in your life. It's okay to just have a little distance.
Well, now is it easy with people we see all the time—the friends, the family, the coworkers—to just take it for granted and drop the politeness? Not on purpose. Just let it go. How do we keep it rolling in those situations and not take those close people for granted?
I think that's key, right? Like, you want to have it's tricky because a little too much formality is ridiculous in close personal relationships. But, you know, I have great friends with whom I speak every day, and there are certain ritual qualities to that friendship that are really important. The way we buy gifts for each other, the way that, you know, I invited this guy over to my house last weekend and with his family, and I told him not to bring anything, and he's from Lebanon, and he texted me beforehand, and he was just like, "It's not an option. I need to bring something." I feel that those rituals actually they deepen the friendship and they make it more valuable because you kind of get to know there are these certain fundamental patterns that you can always trust are going to be there, and they help you as you build loyalty. And it's, I think people would see them as like, you know, the fact that he had to go buy cookies before he came to the party. Some people might see that as ridiculous. I actually see that as beautiful. There's still a fundamental respect in a very, very close relationship. Mm.
Well, one of the pillars you think of politeness is not talking too much about yourself when you're in a party like that and drawing the other people out. Talk about that.
Well, you know, I just think that, I talk about myself too much. I'm talking about myself right now. But if I was in a situation in which I was talking to someone, let's say somebody who worked in public radio, one of the things I point out in my piece, it's just a little trick that when you're in conversation and someone is talking about what they do, if you just turn around and say, you know, that actually sounds kind of hard. Everyone thinks their job is hard, and everyone actually does have hard aspects to their job. And it's a good way to kind of draw them out and get them to talk about things that bug them. Now, I had an interesting experience. I wrote about this, and a guy wrote me after, and he was like, you know, actually, for me, that's the worst possible response. I'm a specialist in pediatric cancer, and I actually love my job. Like, I love what I do. And hearing that must be hard and all the sympathy that people put forth actually makes me feel sort of alien and weird. But my initial response was like, yeah, like, of course you love dealing with that. That's why you went to medical school. That's what you do. But, I would immediately want to be like, oh, man, I bet that hospital bureaucracy is a pain. Mm.
Great tactic. Well, we're talking about politeness, how to be polite, and why it matters with Paul Ford. He's joining us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. We've got a link to a piece he wrote on politeness over at the Central Time Facebook page.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you make a point of being polite? And what does politeness mean to you? Is it the thank you note, the favor, or just being pleasant in day-to-day interactions? And do you think politeness is becoming a lost art these days? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now about politeness with Paul Ford. In a recent piece, he shared his ideas on how and why we should be and can be polite.
You can join the conversation. Do you consider yourself a polite person? Have you been described as weirdly polite, like our guest has? Where do we fall down on politeness as a culture? Is it at work, among family and friends, with strangers? And do we in Wisconsin and the Midwest deserve our polite, friendly reputation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Laura with us in Oshkosh. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Rob. I'd like to think that I'm polite, but honestly, my kids, both teenagers, say I'm very impolite. And I'm not sure what it is. I think I'm maybe a little too honest, and I kind of say it like I see it. But the thing that I try to do at work that I think has helped me a lot with relationships is when I send emails, I always start off with a good morning, a good day, or a good afternoon, and I always end with God bless, because I work at a Catholic school, and that, you know, fits in with our school. But just that small little good morning kind of sets the tone for a polite email.
Interesting. Laura, thanks for that. Paul, you work in the technology business. Do other people follow Laura's example in electronic communication?
I rarely see God bless. No, I think it's there's such an emphasis on brusqueness and quickness that I don't see a lot. But where you do see it is when people are there's a certain formal etiquette to creating and writing code and documenting it and working as a group. So there is actually a very formal, structured, polite culture around code development that you wouldn't necessarily know about unless you were a big nerd.
Interesting.
Well, I am a big nerd, but I'm not a programming nerd, so I don't know that world.
What about, is there a code of politeness for nerds, Rob?
I think we fall down on the job a lot, actually. Yeah.
I mean, if you do poke around, there's a lot of guides to netiquette and guides to how to behave on the internet. It's a major subject.
Yeah, nobody's reading them, though, I don't think. It's a problem. All right, Mike in Madison is next. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Rob. Thanks. It's a great show. I consider myself polite, and I go out of my way to be polite to strangers and people I know. And I think people are protective at first, but when you're polite to them, I believe they jump at the chance to be polite back. And then the other thing is I do believe, I don't know, maybe it's sort of a Buddhist thing, but I believe that in being polite, kind to people, I send an energy out into the world that may or may not come back, but it makes the world a better place, a more positive place.
Okay, thanks, Mike. And Mike talking again about a little bit of spirituality-based politeness and sending good energy out. Is that part of it, do you think?
I mean, I'm not a very spiritual or religious person, but I feel that ethic is really in there, right? Because you're trying to create something, you're trying to just sort of not put yourself first. And also, people, you're also willing to let people see you as passive or beta or whatever they want, however they like to classify human beings. You're willing to let them judge you a little bit while you pace this relationship and give them some respect. And, you know, the thing I would close on that idea is that this piece generated a lot of conversation. I remember reading one on the website Metafilter. Somebody wrote about being polite to people at their job, which involved working with people in severe distress, like people who it wasn't clear where they were, but maybe it was a mental hospital and maybe one where people were being brought in by the police. And they just hadn't been respected. And these people hadn't had any respect in days or weeks or months, and just they were in a state of panic and extreme distress, and this person would calm them down simply by, you know, sir, how are you? Ma'am, how are you? Can I get you anything? Calling them by their name. So it can be a gift that way.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Emily with us in Madison. Emily, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about the impact that handwritten thank you notes have. I really think that I've gotten the best responses from people when I just write a quick thank you note and say, thank you so much for doing this, that they say people don't write handwritten thank you notes anymore. And then also if you can write down some information about people, you don't see that often, but if you can say, oh, Jane, how's your kids? Or how are their horseback riding lessons going? It really shows that you've taken an interest in them and you don't have to put that much work into it. You just have to take a note.
Emily, thanks a lot for that. I'm really bad about the handwritten thank you note, but at my nth birthday party, I won't put a number on it, people were really nice and did lovely things. And I said, all right, this time I'm going to do it. And I wrote handwritten thank you notes. I'm sure they were quickly recycled. Is that on your arsenal of politeness, Paul?
I'm a disaster. I can't pull it off. However, I will say that piece is actually directly inspired a friend of mine from years ago. She's actually since passed away. But if you Google how to write a thank you note, it was a friend of mine named Leslie Harpold wrote a piece that was actually very much the inspiration for how to be polite. And so there's definitely a connection between those ideas of sort of taking the time and being very personally, directly grateful and interacting.
Great. Well, thank you for that call. And we're going to move on to Chris in Eau Claire. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for the show. It's a good topic. I grew up in Arizona, in Phoenix, and when I moved to Eau Claire, at first I was I was paranoid at the people like looking at me and smiling, because it's a totally different mindset in the Midwest, in Wisconsin and Eau Claire in particular, than it was in Phoenix. And thanks for the topic, and yeah, thank you.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for listening and for thanking us. And Eau Claire, people smile a lot and freaked Chris out a lot at first, but is that part of being polite, acknowledging people with a smile, reaching out to them? I guess just the acknowledgement of that, there's another person there and you're going to be friendly.
You know, I just read a piece today about somebody who worked as a postal worker, and it can be a very stressful job. There's a lot of labor issues going on. And what she wrote was just waving at the person driving the postal truck can actually really brighten their day. It can be a real affirmation in a very tough time. And there's just nothing like it. Like, just it's that moment of human connection, I think, brings people's levels right down.
But if you do that in Phoenix or elsewhere, it's going to make them paranoid. Like, what are they after? Why are they waving at me? Thanks a lot, Chris, for the call. Jay joins us now in Pewaukee. Jay, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jay?
I was told something that's kind of stuck with me all my life when I was pretty young. Someone said, your friends are like your teeth. You only get to keep the ones that you pay attention to. And you're talking about being courteous, to step outside of everything and actually let your friends know that you care, to go out and go that extra mile and let them know. Handwritten thank you notes, it's a huge thing. I mean, nobody even writes letters anymore, let alone thank you note, or even small favors. I think it's a decent topic today, and I just wanted to kind of chime in.
Jay, thanks. So some kind of a preventive maintenance is needed for friends, just like teeth, Paul.
It's hard, too, because, you don't want to feel like you're a bother. And when you get out of the practice of just being nice and generous, which happens to me all the time, you forget. And my instinct is always to be like, great job, you're so great, it's so fantastic, and so on and so forth. And then you start to feel like, they don't want to hear that. They're going to just think I'm cheesy, and so on. But the truth is, like, we all have a pretty bottomless need to just know we're doing okay. And so it's never a bad idea.
I want to touch on one more red flag, an enemy of politeness, and that is the unwelcome touch, particularly of people's hair, I guess. Can you talk about that?
You know, I think it's a specific cultural thing, but I'd read a few pieces online, and it's just one of those things where it's like, and the pieces were written by African-American women, and they're just like, why do white people keep touching my hair? And I felt that was a very fair question, but it also just struck me as like, Yeah, why? Like, how? I don't touch anybody's hair. I wouldn't do that unless they said, like, please touch my hair, or they were maybe, like, under 6 months old. Like, it just was so inconceivable to me that you would feel comfortable upon just meeting someone to jump that barrier. And it's culturally, it can be, I don't think that's a universal globally, but it's just kind of obvious. Like, it's just a cue that I feel that, you know, there's a lot of those cues and they're out there. And if you pay attention to them, again, like, that's a relationship you're not going to have. If you touch someone and they don't invite that touch, that friendship is kind of, you just cut off a lot of opportunities for communication. And then people get very offended when you say, please don't. And I've noticed that, you know, I'm a sort of casual but not too intense hugger, and I'm a definite handshaker, but I live in neighborhoods and I interact with people where for religious reasons, physical touch is really, especially between men and women, is really an issue. And so I've learned, you know, and actually someone wrote into that piece, and they told me that when dealing with and interacting with Muslim women, some of them, like, hand over heart is better than handshake. And I went, played back the relationships I'd had before and realized that I'd had some really kind of awkward handshakes, but they were kind of dealing with me because I'm just a regular white American dude. And, like, that hand over heart, that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's kind of
nice.
I'm glad
I know that.
Well, we got to leave it there. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
What a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with writer and programmer Paul Ford. We have a link to his piece on politeness on the Central Time Facebook page, and you can share your thoughts there, too.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get some ideas for cooking with pumpkin.
First, State Superintendent Tony Evers unveiled his plan to close Wisconsin's education achievement gap in his State of Education address yesterday. Wisconsin has the widest achievement gap between black and white students of any state in the nation. In Wisconsin, black students drop out of school at a rate of 1 in 3, and Native American and Hispanic kids at a rate of 1 in 4.
In his speech, Evers called on the task force he put together back in April to provide recommendations for helping Wisconsin students achieve at similar academic levels. He also directly addressed the issue of the classroom disconnect that he says can come from middle-class white teachers teaching poorer children of color. Here with us to talk about the superintendent's address is Scott Kirst. He's assistant professor of education at St. Norbert College. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So what is the goal, the purpose of a state of education speech like this?
Well, a state of education speech like this is it's actually a wonderful opportunity for the general public to get a chance to see what's going on with the state of education in Wisconsin. A lot of times we hear just the good or just the bad, and this is a wonderful way for him, for the superintendent, to get the word out on the wonderful things and the initiatives that we're doing for the state of Wisconsin.
And you mentioned the good, and Secretary Evers mentioned things like graduation rates and ACT scores, but he talked a lot about gaps in outcomes among Wisconsin students by race, by income, that sort of thing. How crucial an issue are gaps like these, disparities like this, for education?
Well, you know, every educator goes into teaching knowing and wanting and caring to reach every single child in that classroom. So I think it's a huge initiative. It's something that we really need to focus on. I don't think any teacher will say, well, I'm good just reaching a few students in my classroom. Every teacher cares about every student that they have in their classroom. And I think this is a great way to remind everyone that we're all here together to actually try to educate all of our youth.
We'll get into some of the specifics of the plan in a moment, but I understand we often use the phrase achievement gap. You prefer opportunity gap. Why is that?
Correct. I I think that if you say achievement gap, that's saying that the child is not achieving, that the child is not doing enough, that the child is the problem. Whereas the term opportunity gap says we have not given the opportunities to our children to all reach the same level of success. And I think it takes it off us blaming the children or blaming the parents or blaming the teachers and saying, you know, we're all part of a team, parents, teachers, community, children, students, we're all part of this together, and we as adults have to provide the proper opportunities for every single student in Wisconsin.
Now, Superintendent Evers laid out some of those efforts from the adults to change that gap. What did you see in the speech that you think are the highlights of the plan?
I think the biggest thing is that focusing on the teamwork between everyone and having that engagement of the teachers and engagement of the parents and engagement of the students and all being on the same team. Sometimes I feel as if a lot of teachers or a lot of parents might feel that there are odds with each other, whereas I think we all need to sit at the same side of the table and take a look at this. So I really thought that was a positive thing that he talked about. I love the idea of how teacher preparation programs need to start talking about how we need to integrate race into our discussions more and more and more, so that when our students go out there, they have the tools to give the opportunities to every student to be able to learn. I know there's a lot of teachers, a lot of new teachers that are out there that don't have a lot of tools in their toolkit, and you know, we have all been trying to give them more and more tools to be better educators.
Well, and let's follow up the last point you made. Evers said a big problem here is we've got teachers who are white and middle class teaching kids who are often low income and non-white. You work in teacher training. How do you set up a teacher for success in that situation?
Well, the pre-service teachers, the ones that we're educating, they have actually most of the opportunities that they have while they're learning are in schools of lower socioeconomic status. They do have that expertise there. We have a lot of coursework that is designed specifically in addressing the diverse needs of students, not only diverse with learning levels, but also with disabilities or their or race. Or there's a lot of different ways in which we need to incorporate that. You need to reach the student first before you start teaching. And I know that most of our students appreciate that because teaching is not something that can be done in a vacuum. I can't just give a lesson plan to our pre-service teachers and they could do it. They need to know their students, and that's the primary focus, the first thing they need to look at to make their education special, that they could actually reach the students where they are, not where they expect them to be.
You also mentioned the idea of better teamwork and cooperation between parents, communities, teachers, administration. I mean, that sounds great and it sounds obvious, but how do you operationalize that? How do you put it into practice so we see more of that?
You know, and I think there's a lot of wonderful ways that parents and teachers and administration put that together. There are a lot of after-school programs. There's a lot of different even just notes home or letters to the parents or letters to the teachers. I think it's okay. Parents and teachers need to know that it's okay to talk to each other, and that's what makes a good, solid team. A lot of teachers really would crave parents coming in and saying, hey, what can I do? What can I do to help my children? What can I do to help you? And I think a lot of teachers want to help the parents as well. This is what you can do to help your students. How to operationalize it? There's a lot of, and we do talk about socioeconomic status, there's a lot of technology out there that is that can be utilized. But again, we have issues with access for a lot of parents. So what we need to do is actually, I think, make this, as Tony Evers said, a priority that we need this communication, and we need to prioritize that as something that is proceduralized and something that is routine and that parents and teachers know they can do.
And there's a task force that's been working on disparity issues. It was just getting off the ground earlier this year. What do you see as the main mission of the task force that the superintendent created?
I really think the main focus is that this task force will give realistic ideas at all those levels in the community, for parents, for teachers, for administration, and give them suggestions on things that have worked, research that they have seen be successful within their classroom, and then share that. That dissemination is so important. There are wonderful things going on in every school in Wisconsin, but not every other school in Wisconsin understands what's going on. So I think this task force is going to be a good repository of valuable, real information and opportunities that other schools can use to actually help this achievement or opportunity gap.
And the chair of that task force, Superintendent Means of the Mequon-Thiensville District, said, quote, flat out, if you look at the data, a rich African-American kid or rich Hispanic kid will probably still achieve at a lower level than a poor white kid. Why this racial gap, even when we factor out income?
Well, I think, like I said, that opportunity gap, there could be many, many reasons. One being the different races between the teachers and the students, and there's not a connection between that teacher and student. I cannot downplay the importance of actually having that connection between the parents or the role models and the children. So I think an African-American student might not be able to relate to learning when a white suburban male or female is in there. Whereas if we were able to transcend that, to get more African American teachers in, to get more individuals that actually can relate to the students, I think we could really turn that around.
We've seen a lot of different efforts when it comes to the achievement gap or opportunity gap in Wisconsin. Summer school, early child education, extra reading and math classes for underperforming students. Magic wand in your hand, what is one change you would make that you think would help close the gap?
One change to help change the gap. Wow. Let's see. I don't have my magic wand with me. I really think the communication and the recognition that the parents, the community, and the teacher are a team, and we're all there for the children, that we need to work together, that it's not adversarial, that it's together, and then communicate and be if every parent and every teacher was engaged in their students' learning, I think that would be my magic wand.
Now, a lot of attention when it comes to schools and school districts facing trouble goes to Milwaukee and elsewhere in southeast Wisconsin. How about, though, the rural schools? We've seen things like declining enrollment, declining tax bases, consolidation of some districts. Do we see that as a priority for the Department of Public Instruction? Did it come up in the speech yesterday?
I think yes, it did, and I think any time that any subset of Wisconsin schools is not achieving, I think that's quite appropriate to look at. If we're not meeting the needs of just a few students, we need to focus on that, and that's the biggest priority, is that we're reaching every student where they are as a team, so that we can build up that education. So yes, I mean there have been some issues in the rural areas of Wisconsin, and that's something that the community, that our economy, that it's a large problem that unfortunately a magic wand is not working on right now at this time.
Now, discouraging news when we see reports showing Wisconsin worst in the nation by some measures of disparity. Are you encouraged, though, that it seems like everyone at just about every level is having this conversation now?
Yeah, actually having it disseminated and researched and actually having it out there, you know, we are consciously competent that this is an issue right now. And, you know, and with that, it takes some work, some effort, some laser beam focus on saying, okay, good, now it's underneath the spotlight, what can we do? And I think every teacher, they love telling about the success stories about their students, but I think every teacher is more interested in where can I do better? What students am I missing? And that's the same thing in our teacher education programs here. We're wondering, where can we do better? How can we prepare them? I think every administration says, how can we support our teachers? How can we support our students? So I think by putting that light on it, I think it's welcoming, because then we could actually have this dialogue and we can start seeing what best practices are within Wisconsin.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Scott Kirst, Assistant Professor of Education at St. Norbert College, talking about Wisconsin's State of Education address delivered yesterday. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Fall officially started this week, which means it's time again for all things pumpkin to overrun our palates. Pumpkin spice lattes, pumpkin beer, pumpkin Oreos. But has it gone too far? Have we reached peak pumpkin?
For now, we'll squash those concerns and embrace the annual pumpkin craze. For Food Friday today, we found a pumpkin expert to fill us in on how to cook with pumpkin. Michael Crondell is with us. He's a food historian and author of The Great Little Pumpkin Cookbook. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. And how could you say there could be too much pumpkin?
Well, but, I mean, pumpkins are in, it seems like, don't you think?
Absolutely. And they should be.
So what is it about pumpkins? You were ahead of the curve. What is it about pumpkins that made you decide to write a cookbook about them?
Well, you know what? I mean, to be serious anybody can, as anyone can be about pumpkins, they are surprisingly versatile, and you only learn this when you start exploring the cuisines of other cultures, because we tend to, you know, putting pumpkin Oreos aside, we tend to just really make pumpkin pie out of pumpkins, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you go to south of France, they have pumpkin that's, you know, gratinade. If you go to Belgium, you've got pumpkin soup. If you've got go other places, you've got pumpkin cheesecake. So you can do a lot more with pumpkins than people think that you can.
Right, a lot of savory applications. I was hearing you talk there and remembering being in New Zealand, and they seem to use pumpkin there the way we use squash here.
Exactly. In fact, there's some confusion about, particularly in Australia, what is a pumpkin and what is a squash. But that actually exists here as well, because most of the pumpkins that you want to use for cooking are closer to a squash, and butternut squash was actually developed out of a kind of a pumpkin.
Hmm. So when we're buying a pumpkin to, you know, when a recipe calls for it, are we thinking big jack-o'-lantern-sized pumpkin, or what are the signs of a good pumpkin to work with for cooking?
Well, the first thing you have to realize is a whole bunch of different varieties of pumpkins out there, and they're grown for different things, so that your average jack-o'-lantern pumpkin is grown to be pretty. It's like a flower. It's meant to be very thin-skinned, so you can carve it nicely. It's meant to be, you know, very, very pumpkin-looking, but it's lousy for cooking. What you want to find is something called a cheese pumpkin. This is a tan-colored pumpkin. This is the kind of pumpkin that butternut squash was developed out of, and in many cases you can substitute butternut squash for this kind of pumpkin, but they're typically called a cheese pumpkin. There's actually a variety called a Wisconsin cheese pumpkin, believe it or not. And they've got very, very thick orange shells, but they're kind of lumpy looking on the outside.
Is there anything cheese-like about them? Where does the name come from?
I think the name came from the fact that they kind of look like a big wheel of Gouda or something like that.
All right. Well, so what do they taste like?
They taste a lot like butternut squash, actually.
So what kind of things, what kind of savory dishes do you like to make with a good, solid cheese pumpkin?
My totally favorite thing is something that is super simple to make, but is crazy tasty. And when I tell you what goes into it, you'll understand why. And you can only make it with a cheese pumpkin. And what you do is you knock off the top, you haul out, you know, all the stuff inside that you don't want, you know, the seeds, the sort of the stringy stuff. And then you start layering it with, like, crusty toasted French bread, grated sharp cheese, like a Gruyere cheese, creme fraiche, which is kind of like that tangy, heavy cream that the French use. And you do layer of this. Put a lot of salt and pepper in there. Put the top back on and seal it with foil and bake it for a couple of hours until it is just, you can just pierce it with a knife and then let it sit around. And what you end up afterwards with is this savory, sweet, cheesy, creamy pudding that obviously would make a great accompanying dish to, you know, Thanksgiving, and you would actually probably forget that there was turkey on the table.
So you would serve this in the pumpkin. So it's actually kind of a smashing centerpiece.
Right, exactly. You serve it in the pumpkin. So it has this kind of great look to it.
Now, I like to use pumpkins for soup a lot. Any advice on making a great pumpkin soup?
Pumpkin soup is like the simplest thing in the world. When my daughter was growing up and wouldn't eat any vegetables, I just fed her pureed pumpkin soup because she would eat it because it's smooth and tasty and sweet. Very simple. You just chop. Actually, the easiest thing to do is you roast the pumpkin off until it's soft and tender. Scoop out the flesh. Saute some onions. Add some good vegetable stock or chicken stock. Obviously, it's going to be better homemade, right? And then you cook it until the onions are very, very soft. You add that cooked, baked squash or pumpkin to it. And then you throw the whole thing in the blender after you're done. And the great thing about it is that not only is it good made that day, but if you make like a triple quantity, it freezes like a dream.
Hmm. Wow. Well, and our producer Galen wants to know about candied pumpkin. So that's an interesting one. How do you candy pumpkin?
Candied pumpkin, you know, speaking of like all people all over the world having candied pumpkin, apparently, I have not tasted this, but I've read about it. In India, in Agra, they have a specialty of candied pumpkin. And what you do with the pumpkin, and the Portuguese do something like this too, you just cook pumpkin chunks in a syrup until it becomes, the pumpkin chunks become kind of transparent. And then eventually you pull it out of the syrup and let it drip off and that sort of a thing. And depending on the culture that does this, the Mexicans do it too, you get a somewhat different texture. And, you know, it probably depends on how much sugar there is, how long you cook it, and the specific variety that you use.
And now if we do want to be old-fashioned and make the pie, what do we do to make a great fresh pumpkin pie really pop?
Well, the first thing you do is you do not buy one of those jack-o'-lantern pumpkins, right? Mm-hmm. You buy a good cheese pumpkin if you want to make it from scratch. And I hate to admit this, but I often use the canned stuff. You didn't hear it from me. I will deny it. But the thing is, so you roast it. You scoop out the insides. You cover it lightly with foil. And you roast it until it's very, very soft. Now, here's the trick. When Libby's fills those cans, they don't just cook up the pumpkin and put it in the cans. They let it drain. And that's what you need to do. So once you've roasted the pumpkin, put it in a colander, a sieve, something like that.
Oh.
And let it hang out, ideally overnight, but even 2 or 3 hours. And you'll lose something like 50% of the water. At which point you've got this thick, dense puree that, again, if you've got extra, freezes beautifully. You can add the pumpkin soup later. But that's what you want to use for that, you know, custardy pumpkin pie. And buy good quality of raw sugar. That's what I think also, because if it's got that little bit of molasses flavor to it, it does improve things. You know, don't buy just regular old light brown sugar. Go out of your way and buy kind of the fancy stuff.
You've explained my pumpkin pie failures of the past. Let it drain first.
Otherwise, it's just way watery.
You've made my life better. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Michael Crondell. He's a food historian and author of The Great Little Pumpkin Cookbook. We're starting to see baking pumpkins turn up in gardens, CSAs, farmers markets around the state. He gave us a little help. By the way, he's also the author of Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrer. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.